potrebbe fare, potrebbe tantissimo anche
tanto c'è già lì e si può liberare per
dai dai
c'è un uscito di palma si potrebbe fare tantissimo anche con l'inglese un po' di tanto se lo sapete che forma
dai
sì, il nome c'è la taglia
dai
se il volo si cresce tanto si va a dire dove va a
dire dai
si si va a Krishna Samhita va a dire dove va a
dai
Vrindavan Damki
dai
Madhurya Damki
dai
Navari Damki
dai
Manamai Ki
dai
Kangamai
Ki dai
Vasi Devi Ki
dai
Bhakti Devi Ki
dai
Navair Bhakti Vindi
dai
all glories to the Sambhita
all
glories to the Sambhita all glories to the Sambhita all glories to the Sambhita now what is in the hall what do you need? Let them come in. So, yeah, I always wanted to be a movie star. So, and I said I'll die on the battlefield. So while we are discussing here, we'll tell me this one. I need to preface something to explain, because for some people the topic will be a little unusual today. I mean, we're continuing our series about leaving the body. It's part of one of the meditations that we're reading from the book, the Die Before Dying. And we are about almost half, maybe halfway through with some of the discussions. See, in Vaishnava theology, there's very clear, distinct understanding about the nature of the soul. And there's tremendous elucidation about the soul's relationship to God. And it's, for instance, when we hear about going to heaven or going to the kingdom of God, going back to God, the Godhead, then normally we look at this as the conclusion. But it's really, it's actually the real beginning. Because while we are in these material bodies, we are, of course, out of sync, we're out of our natural existence, we're away from our original relationships. And the whole process of spiritual realization is to give up jiva kosha, give up false ego, is to come to the point of the Vasudeva platform, literally, of being able to see and connect and associate with, you know, with the Lord, literally face to face. So then the question may be asked, then who is God? Who are we? What do we do when we return back to the kingdom of God? If the goal of most religions is to once again to become pure, the Bible says the pure in heart shall see God. Many times I mentioned about the hadith, so the complementary to the Quran, it says the highest experience in paradise is to behold the vision of Allah. And that from great knowledge comes pure association. Well, what is that knowledge that can bring us to pure association? Bhagavatam explains that in order to have proper purity, one must, or to hear with rapt attention, one must be pure in actions. In order to be pure in action, one must be pure in thoughts. And to be pure in thought, one must be pure in their eating, sleeping, mating, defending, etc. So all of these things lead to pure thought, to pure hearing. And when the hearing is pure, then it means that we're able to act and to respond to the transcendental message. the other day, and Gitanagar mentioned how Bhaktivinoda mentioned three things as necessary: Shravan, Mohan, and Smaran. To hear, and then to reflect or to meditate on, ponder upon, and then to remember. Because once realization is there, once knowledge is given, once a prescription is given, then one must also remember it, to care it for feel, or to remember how to use it in the right way, in the right time. So I continue with, I was thinking of which meditation to give. First, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to speak today. Maybe you heard last night, I got kind of on the faster track. I was having, for the last 2 weeks, I was having some pulsating in the, over the catheter area. And we thought maybe there's an infection of the catheter, but then I had a CAT scan yesterday, and it's actually cancer advancing. So, yesterday I fractured my, collarbone. While I was waiting to get the CAT scan, and so what happened is that the cancer has eaten out at the bone and made the bone very thin. And so, right, that's why I didn't come down. I basically can't walk very well. So it's like this side of the body is paralyzed almost. Well, some of you broke collarbone, you know. You were a sportsman or you had some other issue. So when you move, almost any movement, it's like the bone comes forth or whatever. You can't put a cast on it, so it's no different. So anyway, all this is causing me to realize how we are kind of moving faster than we thought. So when it's in the bone, then it moves. It's already in the lymphs, you know. And since I left Gitanagari, or even before, day after the festival, actually, the nodes grew larger. So we saw this Krishna's arrangement of then just be able to have that festival and to be as present as possible. And now maybe some closure is taking place. You know, we'll see. Anything can happen, can turn around, or we can be procrastinated. We're not looking at treatments to stop because perhaps that'll happen, but it doesn't seem like it. We try almost everything. We're looking more at ways to maybe slow it down. Anyway, right now it's going pretty fast. So that was helping me look at again with meditation to select. As I try to humble myself more in terms of just trying to be available for Krishna's service, for Guru's service, available to serve all of you, and to try to see what is to be learned as we go through this, you know, this slow dying process. So I thought I would give a discussion that has to do with an aspect of Ras, the Ras Tattva. Now this means that the Ras, the taste, the relationship, the mellow, since I look up here and I see this picture, that emphasizes about a soul that comes back to the spiritual world and is received by Krishna and the residents of Vrindavan. And Krishna's mood is so intense of welcoming that soul back as well as the resident. So there is this great bond, great ecstasy, great love in receiving. So I was thinking how normally we, when as Vaishnavas, we think, oh yes, I go back home to the spiritual world and I'll be a gopo, a gopa, or I'll be a gopi or something, or a manjari. And I thought, but what about being a rock? And so I'm going to speak today about being a rock in the spiritual world, being a stone. Because even when it comes to the ultimate transcendence, we still may have some artificial desires of how we want to serve. We have our own idea about, you know, how to serve. And the servant is to be able to fulfill the desires of the master. So the master says, bring me water, you don't bring milk. I say, well, milk is now is more nourishing. And so if they call for the jiva in the original sarup is to serve in neutrality or serve as a rock, then yes, wonderful. Now, that may sound a little unusual. People say, oh yes, I hear these people from Eastern thought they worship cows and I hear they worship rocks. Yeah, it's true. They worship Shalagram. Like in Mecca, they worship the Kaaba. It's the same stone that we use in Shalagram. They say, well, people say they don't worship it. The Jews don't worship it, they don't really want, but they do. You cry and you pray and you circle and emulate. That's worship. The idea that it's connected with various aspects of divinity. We worship according to things connected with God's rupa, different forms, his lila, his pastimes, his guna, his qualities. And so we don't engage in idol worship, but we worship in relationship to what is authorized, authorized video ways to connect deeper and to have more personal understanding and association with the Lord. So, just to bring everyone up to date, those who will be listening who may find it strange that you can serve in different ways, you can serve as a rock. Normally we think of God as the Aishvarya, or we think of the Supreme Controller, the Paramishwara. People think that, we think of God as the one who creates and destroys. And that's a certain way to respect the Godhead. He's a great creator and the maintainer, everything resting upon him. We say it's just pearl strung upon a thread. Matapalatanana, yet kinsida sitananjaya. Isabhaminam proktam sutri manakaniva. That just like, you know, we have our japa beads, our mala, one has a rosary, one bead is connected to another bead. So Bhagavad Gita says that everything is resting upon the Lord, such a systematic way. But in the higher expressions, in the higher mellows, the higher ras, one serves God with less awareness, cognizance of his autocratic nature, or his without the formality of bureaucracy. And love is very, very powerful. Somehow you don't think that my lover is president of the United States, or he's manager, CEO of this company, or he's a judge, or whatever you think that. You know, you love it. And the little child doesn't think so much the father in that way, but thinks this is my father. So one can have relationship with Lord and Santa Rasa, Rasa of neutrality, can serve in a passive way, like a rock or a tree, or the Sufi gaze in service. One can serve the Lord in the mood of a servitude-ship, which one normally thinks in most religions. One can serve in the mood of Sankhya Aras, a mood of friendship. Like the Bible says, Abraham had a relationship with the Lord. It's like friend. And Muhammad is said to have had a relationship in the mood of Sankhya. And that once he explains how that he puts his hand on the Lord's shoulder and he gets the transmission of the messages. And so this would be considered in the mood of Sankhya Aras. And one can serve the Lord in Vatsalya. That's like as a parent. And there's a discussion of Sarah having a relationship in the Bible with Jesus in that mood. But it's Maya Soda, so many other in the Vedic tradition. But one is really thinking and relating to the Lord in a mood of the Lord is being their child, perfect child. And then there is a conjugal, where like nuns take the vows, certain orders of being the bride of Jesus. Well, there's what is called bridal mysticism in the sciences, conjugal rites. Well, there's the life of St. Francis of Assisi, St. Bernard, St. Teresa, you go on and on. And, or even the Song of Solomon, which is all discussions of conjugal rites, speaking of the Lord. And one being like female, and the Lord being male, whether one is in a physical female body or physical female body, male body, the one is thinking of the Lord in terms of being the prakriti, of being the servant, and being a lover. So, usually we may think, or want to think of ourselves, that ultimately we have a relationship, and this is the esoteric aspect of Vaishnavism, we usually may think more in terms of being a friend or assisting in friendship ras or assisting in conjugal ras. But what if the Lord wants us to assist another way? Our relationship is another way. It's a tree or a stone or a rock, the eternal spiritual world. Because in the kingdom of the Lord, that it's since harmony is everything is alive. So it's not just being in the forms we normally relate to as masculine and feminine. There's life, as we see, even in the material world, insects and animals and so many, and even germs are alive. But the difference is that in the material world, things are alive, but of course they come from the part of the culture, they're part of the suffering, but in the right culture, free of misery, free of suffering, and life is temporary. Now, so we're going to read a little meditation on being a stone in Vrindavan. But before that, we look at the different aspects of liberation. This will maybe bring us in a little more. As our discussions, again, are for people with Christian backgrounds, Muslim backgrounds, as well as for yourselves, without being trite to what you already know. But as we speak in these classes, and we're talking to dozens of people from different backgrounds. So, we find in the Bhagavatam, the Vedic scriptures, there are different stages of liberation, bona fide stages where one is transcending. First is called Sisayuja. And normally we know the yogis and the mystics and are very much acquainted with this. This is merging into the energies of the Lord. And so usually people who refer to and talk about Sisamadhi, sometimes even refer to Nirvana, they're looking more at the experience of the effulgence that's connected with transcendence, with the Godhead, with the spiritual world. They're looking more at rising outside of the limitations of the physical body, being able to have some initial experiences with the soul, with that is beyond matter. And so that is kind of a spiritual intoxication. Sort of similar to someone is cooking and you are smelling the aroma. So the aroma is real because it's associated with the actual food. But it's a part of the reality. It's the fragrance. Or you smell the cologne or the perfume of your beloved. So it's real and it's stimulating because it's connecting you, but it's there because it's coming from something else. It's the Shakti who's connected with the Shakti Ma. Energetic. So this experience of aroma is so overwhelming that sometimes when yogis experience it, they feel there's nothing more to experience. And so they have many books and discuss many things and how they have become God, become one with everything. And it's sort of similar to, well, a mundane example, a psychedelic intoxication, where one will feel sometimes a great oneness with everything, if like you can do anything, because of an altered state of awareness. So this is an altered state, but a transcendental state is the aroma. So then after Sayuja, there's what is, and then that goes on to being able to have experience of the Lord in the heart, you know, the Paramatman and see Bhagavan. But the stages is that then there's what is called Viswarupa, where one can have the same body as the Lord. This is usually in relationship to an aspect of the spiritual kingdom called the Vaikuntha, where everyone has the same form, look like the Lord, but still serve the Lord in a certain amount of awe and reverence. So it's kind of a kingly type of environment, but everyone is king. But then there's a super king. That's the supreme. And then there is Sarsi, where everyone not only has, say, the same form, but all the same opulences and the same powers. And then there's what is called Sitalitya, where one resides eternally with the Lord in Vrindavan, or outside of the realm of just heaven, outside of the realm of Vaikuntha. Some of our viewers may wonder, what is beyond heaven? These people, they don't worship God, they're talking about something that's beyond heaven. But yes, every tradition, Orthodox traditions, explain there's something beyond heaven. The Bible says in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So was that really the beginning? Because God was already existing. If he created the heavens and the earth, what was he and what was he doing before he created the heavens and the earth? It says, let us make man in our image. You know, God, if it's the Supreme Godhead who's talking, then what is he, who is he talking to if he's the only one existing? This is the Devas involved in what we, what most people see as a primary creation, but a secondary aspect of creation. God doesn't have to say, let us create man in our image. If he is the original creator, who is he talking to? Let's create something like a man, some species called man in our image. And so therefore we know that there was an abode that the Lord resided in before he created the heavens and the earth. And that's what we're tuning into now in our meditation. This is very advanced Christianity, very advanced Islam, very advanced Vedic culture or Dharma, which it often means more intimacy and intimate knowledge with the Lord. And that's why St. Francis, St. Teresa and St. Francis of Assisi, this is why they had this real personal relationship, because they realized they used their religion as a powerful vehicle to open up, to connect deeper and deeper with the higher reality. This is why sometimes some Sufi practitioners, they talk about this personal relationship and the power of calling the name of the Lord, and also being the lover of the Lord. So they have used a certain religion, a certain tradition, and they have, well, worshiping ultimately the same God, how they may know about that same God, worshiping the same God, and as the heart and mind is sincere, then that Lord is in the heart, reciprocates with each jiva accordingly. And sometimes reciprocates even beyond the general patterns of that particular theology. So I may be basically in, you know, high school, but they're in an enriched state. And although they're in high school, they've been given tutoring that's at the level of university. So each religion, in general, has a certain level of transmission. And it's obvious. That's why Jesus said, I have much to tell you, but you're not ready to hear it yet. He was letting them know, hey, I'm telling you guys a lot. But even though you're my 12 disciples, there's more. We've explained, we reiterate, how Muhammad was given three kinds of knowledge. One, knowledge that he was to tell the people everything that he was told. Second level of knowledge, he was to decide what to give. The third level of knowledge, that he was not to reveal. And Islamic scholars, they know this is a fact. And Buddhist scholars know that Buddha also did not say that he had given everything. He said the opposite in the teachings of Amida Buddha. So then, what is that? Or where is that you can find more? You say, anybody can say, well, we get more. Well, you let the scriptures speak for themselves. And the ambassadors speak for themselves. If they in fact said that they were given everything. If they weren't, then what else was there? And what was the process? And those who seemingly have acquired something even greater than the general theology, what did they do? Well, we see a serenity. We see the level of surrender that was there of St. Bernard and others, that they were trying to be all for God, and so therefore the Lord in the heart, you know, reciprocated. We say Paramatma, then say the Holy Ghost. So this Saloka is where one is residing in the spiritual world and being able to serve the Lord in that mood of Madhurya, or in the mood of Sankhya, of friendship, or in conjugal But one is not thinking of God as the autocrat, or thinking that one, that they're even associating with the Lord. That they're more in the mood of associating with their greatest friend or their greatest lover. So we're kind of going outside of even that paradigm today to look at. But what about being a stone? How much would one be eager, like as a Vaishnava on the spiritual journey, knowing that ultimately you will serve in the spiritual world as a tree or as a stone? As I get closer and closer due to this terminal illness of departing, and we're looking more at the future, which is just an extension of the present, then we also try to access a deeper connection with the Siddhadehi or original nature. He said, well, we see in our own tradition there are different degrees of how the gurus have emphasized the awareness of one's original sarupa, original nature. Our immediate acharya, Śrīla Prabhupāda, did not emphasize that in terms of the science of the specific science that's associated with revelation of the Siddhadehi. But we see that in writings of Bhaktivinoda, in writings of other acharyas, that there were distinct spiritual scientific technologies that was often transmitted by the guru, letting the chela, the disciple, understand who he or she could possibly be in the spiritual world, and or even in the material body, to begin to integrate that into consciousness, into unfoldment. You see the danger of sahajism, the danger of speculation and conjecture and such. But at the same time, we know that it is part of the unfolding science. At the platform of Bhav, one becomes aware of their Siddhadehi. At the platform of Ashadi, it begins to unfold. Let me explain what that means. What are we talking about? In the nine stages, the stages of devotion, we have Shraddha. First is faith. The first one has to have faith to pursue a path, any path. And then with that faith, then one goes to the next step of associating. This is called Sadhu Sangha. And you associate where you can hear more, you can be more with things that's connected with what you're anticipating, because faith has something to do with anticipation of the future. And then there's Bhajan Kriya, where now you are having spiritual mentorship, and you're being given instructions and guidance of certain practices and following those. As you follow those properly, then you reach to anartha nivritti, where certain bad habits and unwanted things begin to become clear, and one becomes to become free of such. And then one comes to the platform of nishtha, which is steadiness. And that steadiness then leads into real taste. First, you're doing things out of duty, out of obligation, because they need to be done. And sometimes one may be doing them out of fear. But then there's ruchi, where those things that were seemingly austerities, you enjoy them. It becomes tasty. You don't want to be without them. First, the prayer, the job of the meditation. It may be almost like an imposition. You're struggling to do it, trying to fit it in. You're doing it, but you're not having any realization that it's not so pleasurable. You mix a lot, because you're supposed to pray five times a day. You promise to do 16 rounds or more. But you do it out of duty. But then when the taste develops, the ruchi platform, ruchi. And then from the ruchi, it develops into a shakti, which is a platform of attachment, and then to vav, where it's like the door to prema. It's opening up, and then prema is a full love of God. Yeah. So these are the stages. And so at the stage of a shakti, vav is where the siddhadehi unfoldment can naturally take place. And Prabhupada explained, and Bhaktisiddhanta also, that is from intense bhajan and blessings from Guru, and without even having to go through the rigorous science that can be very ambiguous and can lead to all kinds of opening of all kinds of doors of confusion, is that this can unfold. So someone may find, according to their level of purity, their adhikara, they may find that they have an eternal relationship with the Lord as a friend or as a lover, or as their brother Reed, as a stone, even daughter. So we'll read this short meditation. We're talking about the different types of liberation and the different stages on the path of bhakti. This is called satisfied to serve as a stone in Vrindavan. And see, keep in mind, we wrote these as we were dealing with this terminal illness in Mexico and also in Hawaii. Now we're reading them with the connection of the mood of how we wrote them, reflecting, and also looking at the present experience while anticipating, you know, the near future. So it's not just sort of a theoretical type of reading. In that sense, hopefully it's not that good for you. But it's a wake-up call for all of us about being more alert about leaving the body, being able to celebrate the experience of going from one room to the next room. Leaving the body is like that. But the question is, what room do we go to? But also doing what is necessary so that we can go to our eternal existence with joy and with full and eventual anticipation. I was dealing with the duality, of course, again, of not wanting to have a slow, painful kind of cancerous death. The bone cancer is, cancer is in the bone, it's a very slow kind of, well, fast, but slow at the same time. Any pain in anything, slow. But then accepting that if this is what is necessary for the preaching spirit, for taking on some additional karma, for serving Guru more emphatically, then all right. Satisfied to serve as a stone in Vrindavan. Sometimes you only think of service to Krishna as possible in the human form, form of life, which can cause us to minimize how Krishna extends himself in many variegated ways to all species. Lord not only provides opportunities for each species to serve him in so many ways, allowing them to receive benedictions, but he also personally incarnates into every species. There are so many pastimes of the Lord that no scripture can even contain all the pastimes. Again, we go back to other traditions. The Bible says of all the things that Jesus did, Son of God did, that the scriptures cannot contain. What we hear about Jesus in Krishnanam is just the 3 years of his existence on the planet. There are many examples of entities and bodies other than the human form getting special mercy from the Lord. Some are surely worth bringing up now. If it's a little warm, we can open up the windows on both sides. The day in Srivastava Kaur's house, we remember how a dog was given before mercy and also liberation. Agada and Sugriva in the bodies of monkeys, Jamavan in a bear's body, Bharat Marj in a deer's body, Surabhi in a cow's body, Yendra in an elephant's body, King Nirga in the body of a lizard, Nalakubera and Manigriva, and twin Jama Arjuna trees. Then there's pastime of Ahala and the body of a stone. It's from the Javadana. Perhaps the completion of my existence in material bodies in the material world will soon end. and I will be fortunate to return to the spiritual world to serve eternally as a stone in Vrindavan. I must ask myself, am I qualified and ready for this service? While residing in human-like bodies, I've engaged in devotional service in so many different ways. I've been instrumental in making devotees and helping to maintain their devotional lives. I found and even created many unique means to bring people closer to the Vaishnava teachings, like these kinds of TV programs we're doing now. I cultivated them personally in some cases and tried to create and maintain communities that would provide a healthy environment for devotees to cultivate their Krishna consciousness. Perhaps the completion of my existence in mature bodies, mature world, will soon end. And I'll be fortunate to return to the spiritual world to serve eternally as a stone in Vrindavan. I must ask myself, am I qualified and ready for this service? While residing in human like bodies, I've been responsible for building of several temples, establishment of several schools. In these facilities, people were able to come for worship and education, for worship and education. In the temples, the devotees and non-devotees could have darshan for the deities, hear transcendental discourses, attend festivals, visit or live there as a way to offer services. They have lots of good associations. In the schools, devotees and non-devotee children could have opportunities. It's like in Ghana and Nigeria, we have our schools, but they're for the whole village. It's a devotee school, and the emphasis is devotee is children. So our devotee children are there, but we're trying to make the study available for the community, for the village, so that people will see that. We're not just concerned with our own theology, or our expressions of our theology is not for our own mukti or liberation, but for the service of the community. I promise you I'm going to cry today, so see if I can get through. In the schools, the devotees and non-devotee children could have opportunities while simultaneously learning academics incorporated in spiritual study. Perhaps the completion of my existence in the mature bodies and mature world will soon end. And I will be fortunate to return. To this spiritual world to serve eternally, this is the only method. I must ask myself, am I qualified? Am I ready for the service? While residing in human abundance, you can read my mind, huh? Read my emotion. or maybe I didn't want you to go without the service. While residing in human-like bodies, I've been instrumental in establishing several farms, communities. In these communities, we try to emphasize simple living and high thinking. We explore self-sufficiency and try to create an atmosphere that emphasizes unity with diversity. We focus on how to properly address and balance spiritual as well as material needs. We also try to prioritize the facilitation of women and children. Halfway through. And perhaps everyone to put love, and try to encourage everyone to put loving Vaishnava relationships as the number one priorities. Perhaps the completion of my existence, a mature body, the mature world will soon end. I will be fortunate to return
to the spiritual world to serve eternally as a strong woman does. I must ask myself, am I qualified and ready for this service? While residing in human-like bodies, I have established some free clinics and outposts for distribution of prasadam and spiritual foodstuff. These facilities, which offer some of the most basic medical assistance and free food, have much more than just a humanitarian purpose. Such services are most important since we must maintain and care for the body. However, these facilities and programs address the whole person, the body, mind, and hopefully the soul. Perhaps the completion of my existence in the mature bodies and mature world will soon end. Now, we're fortunate to return to the spiritual world to serve eternally as a stone of endowment. I must ask myself, am I qualified and ready for this service? Are residing in human-like bodies? I've been able to preach massively on television and radio and cry on radio and TV. We edit all this stuff, huh? And also, I've had contact with many world leaders. All around the world, I've preached to national TV, radio, and newspaper addressing leadership, relationship, nation building, and social degradation. I've offered ways to re-spiritualization of our lives, to assist in such ways, and to solve mature problems with spiritual solutions. I've also given workshops and seminars all around the world to devotee and non-devotee communities on these topics and many more. Perhaps the completion of my existence in the mature body and the mature world will end soon, and I'll be fortunate to return to the spiritual world to serve eternally as a stone of endowment. I must ask, am I qualified and ready for this service? And so, two more papers. While residing in human-like bodies, I distribute many of my spiritual master's books, and I've written and distributed hundreds and thousands of my own books in many different languages. Devotees and non-devotees all around the world have been exposed to my style of writing. In these books, I have tried in my own little way to present ancient Vedic knowledge in a lively way so as to address contemporary issues and concerns. Perhaps the completion of my existence in material bodies, in the material world will end soon. I'll be fortunate to return to the spiritual world to serve eternally as a stone and even daughter. I must ask myself, am I qualified and ready for this service? While residing in human-like bodies, I've made and matured many disciples in connection with all of these other various activities. All of these achievements and endeavors are noble, but they're secondary. In other words, spiritual life is not based on just what we do. We may do a lot, we may not do a lot physically, but it's what we are in consciousness. How much we've gotten rid of disease of the heart, weakness of the heart. Now, the real accomplishments depends on whether or not I've been a proper disciple. We've got to remind ourselves that the guru is as much a guru as that he is a disciple. To the degree that he is a disciple, then he sees his own disciples as an extension of his guru. He sees the disciples as like his own spiritual his mentors who have amplified or divided into many. And so, in disguise, they're with him, before him, for him to serve them by accepting their service and also giving service. So therefore, he must do a mental gymnastic of not having proprietorship and to have the humility and the stewardship of focusing on, here's my chance to serve my guru in many, many ways. So we're saying, so the real concern is not all these other things that we're mentioning. I always blow my horn. But the real concern is, to what degree has one been a proper disciple? If so, I will be Now the real accomplishment depends on whether or not I've been a proper disciple. If so, I will be qualified and ready to serve in the spiritual world eternally as a slave if necessary. And divine slavery is the utmost. To be totally captured by one's beloved and to be forced to do what is even better than what one would do for themselves based on their own intelligence is divine slavery. However, I will be just as enthused or more enthused to serve as a demigod rather than having planets, rather than Vaikuntha, or even as a servant in any of the rasas, or just as the question. However, will I be just as enthused? To serve as a rock, will I be just as enthused? Or to serve in other rasas, if that's the ultimate service, whatever the call, divine slavery, or will be just as enthused? I am that lowly beggar who will depart from material bodies in the near future and who needs special mercy to become qualified and ready and satisfied to serve in an eternal stone in Vrindavan. Okay. I didn't make it quite for you, but without boohooing, every day now. Any questions? So what we looked at is that there are different rasas, different relationships that we have eternally. And everyone has, it's just a matter of laying dormant. In the Harinath Chintamani, Bhakti Vinod explains how as part of the science one may kind of suggest it's sort of ambiguous that we have a kind of relationship, then how is it tailored? Well, it's sort of like you already have a suit and then it may be then adjusted in certain ways. It can be adjusted this way or that way. So he explains how the spiritual master may play that role, that something is already there, dormant, and that the guru may bring on some adjustments. But you can see why the danger is in one jumping the gun, or one trying to meditate on such things without the adhikar, because then speculation, well, I think my service Krishna is the cowherd boy. Maybe not. But at the platform above, then these things do unfold. So we looked at the different levels of different kind of rasas, from neutrality to servitorship, friendship, parental, and conjugal. And we also looked at the different levels of stages of liberation. And of course, the Saloka is being on the same plane as the Lord and being able to have these very intimate type of relationships. But we normally read about, Sayuja and most books of Eastern thought, merging with the Brahman effulgence of the energies of the Lord. So we went to different stages, from Sarupa to Sarsi to Samipya, and all the way up to Saloka. And of course, we then try to look closer at this one aspect of the Ras Tava neutrality. Would one have the same enthusiasm if ultimately they're returning back to the spiritual kingdom, would be as a rock? Now, I think you need to maybe sit on the chair. She just come out the hospital and sit on the floor.
She's trying to come here.
So okay. Just worry about your own health. Are you okay sitting down?
Thank you.
Okay. Just yesterday, just come out of the hospital. You have cancer also.
Yeah.
Colon cancer. So, and that's all of us to ask ourselves. With the knowledge that we have, what we know, what we understand, and this very esoteric and confidential knowledge about the Godhead,
our original nature and associations with Krishna. But we have the same zeal of enthusiasm, knowing that we'll ultimately return back in the spiritual world to be a tree, you know, to be a stone. If we understand that the service is to the Master, and that as we are serving the Lord with full dedication and submission, and in that degree, whatever service that we do, it is totally fulfilling. Then we can understand why, you know, in some other traditions, there's some reference to knowing Godhead, the lover, because it's all a part of the very deep science of the nature of the soul eternal relationship, when one returns back. So we end what we started with. We started with just reflecting on, now if the basic goal of most theologies is to return back to the kingdom of God, then who is God, and what is that kingdom, and what does one do when they enter back home? Is that everyone finally goes back to the kingdom and they say, okay, you made it. You made it too. Oh, it's finally here. It's all over now. Let's just sit down and meditate. No, obviously, there's more than just going across the finish line. It's great adventure and associations and experiences. And that is a science that is not so clearly unfolding for most people, unless they have special blessings. I got an example one time of doing a TV program in Nigeria. It was a national TV show, if I recall. And there were leaders from all the different faiths. And so I made a bold statement, and I meant it. I said, and I wasn't trying to be arrogant, but I was also trying to share and also trying to receive more knowledge if there was. Says, if any of your faiths can share more knowledge about the nature of the soul and the nature of God than what we have in our Bhagavatam, in our Vedic scriptures, that I will join you. And first, I will make an announcement here, right now, on national TV. And I will extend this all around the world to any devotees who have any contact with any of my disciples to encourage them to also to join your faith. I said, so, let us discuss about the nature of the soul and the nature of God. And we know basically there's this idea of God is good, God is great, God is merciful. I said, well, you know, the governor may be merciful and great and powerful, and he's all those things for some people. And even a thief for some people. Sometimes you have thieves who, like in Robin Hood, they steal from one place and they do good another place. So they're also merciful and kind and this and that. That this doesn't give distinct attributes of the God. They said, well, God can't be seen. I said, but your scriptures say he can't be seen. St. John said, not that any man can see God, but he who is of the Father can see God. And I quote the verse in Revelation. It says, how there should be many last chapter in Revelation, there shall be those who shall be known, children of God, they shall see his face, and shall wear the mark of the Lord in their forehead. So what is the face and what is to be seen? You know, what is the drishta? What is the drishta? Who is the seer and what is to be seen? And if we accept that the soul is eternal, then where does it come from? Where does it go? What is the nature of the soul? If they were confused with the soul and the spirit and the soul or the oversoul in terms of the words, but it's even that, what is that? Explain something about the nature of the soul. This is what we are eternally, and where we go eternally to the spiritual kingdom. It seems like we should have the most knowledge about that. Somebody works very hard, and they're not sure what their salary is going to be, what the goal is going to be. Maybe what at the end, you know, they may not be happy. At the end, they may just get just a $10 bonus. And he said, well, I thought you were going to give me a bonus. Yeah, we promised you a bonus. You're working hard. We promised you all along we'll get a bonus. Here are your bonuses, $10. So you want to know is expected, so you can be more enthusiastic about what you're going to experience and what you're going to get. So this kind of knowledge, which is found somewhat in the scriptures, if we just have the key to open the scriptures, if we go deep and open up the major world scriptures of the world, we'll find some traces of this knowledge. Said the Vedic scriptures being one of the oldest collections of scriptures, has such a nice way, a nice compendium of making them available, very accessible in such a way. But if we don't use it, then of course, well, we're not qualified. So that's why through this meditation, I'm saying, of talking about things, but saying, but the real ultimate point is, to what degree has one been loyal to their path, loyal to their you know, discipleship? To what degree have one been able to get the mercy, as well as put forth the proper effort? Effort is there, but to what degree has the mercy descended because of the proper effort? And then, based on that, one would be enthused, however they leave, when they leave, and where they go. So I'm struggling with that. I mean, as I write these, this is real. I'm writing with, why am I going quite so fast? I mean, I'm going to go fast. I didn't think it would be this fast. I could be talking about months or weeks, everything, maybe another year, maybe 2 years. And then my greatest fear was to be totally like an invalid. And now it's like I'm paralyzed on this side almost. It took me, about an hour and a half just to do a shower, not even a shower, but just to wash up and to put on the dhoti. I'm thinking, what is this? You know, you have to help me to move here and move there and do this to that. Because I don't want to break whatever's little there. But then I have to realize, okay, another way to be more dependent on the Lord. Another way to be more eager and ready to accept self-transcendence. And I was laughing at the voice of the other saying, it's almost like there's a part of me that's trying to stay in the body. And so some higher beings are saying, we're going to make it so damn uncomfortable that you don't want to stay. Okay, you guys did a pretty good job. Figured out be this, and back that locks up, a neck that's in arthritis, and advanced cancer, and amputated leg, and thinking, okay, and now fractured collarbone, and metastasized melanoma. Like, oh, well, come on now, what's next? Anyway. Some of the love of devotees to keep me around a little longer. I guess you guys want me to be around a little longer, so we'll see. Any questions? Any comments? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Hand on the microphone.
Yeah. All right, you talked about communities several times in your offer. Mm-hmm. One thing I was reflecting on, I'm still trying to understand. Sometimes you see a community that what we give, it's like a catch 22. And sometimes we say, I'll give only if you give. Mm-hmm. But it seems like that Krishna wants to see that we give, and then when we talk about unconditional service, we give first, and we don't wait until others give in order for ourselves to give. You also gave the example of a high school student receiving tutorial from a tutor and they may be learning things at a college level. Mm-hmm. So my question kind of refers a little bit to that analogy, that in the sense of suppose our own, either due to our own conditioning or our own misperception, or maybe it's back to the case that when we see in our involvement with the community, we think that we're giving more than what others are giving. What can be the inspiration for such a person to develop more of that root of unconditional love, of giving first before waiting?
Well, see, that's where the ambiguity has come. With so much of emphasis on lust being considered to be love. Because of lust, you're more focused on what you can receive, what you can experience. The lust, the one's own sensual concerns is the sinner. So with love, you're happy to know that you can give more. because you're just so, one can become so overwhelmed with trying to do something for or with the beloved that you want to have that kind of competition where you are giving more. And an ideal relationship, the other one is trying to give more, you're trying to give more, etc. But because we are so out of sync of having that experience in almost any kind of relationship we have, then we normally have what we call love, you know, it's like a business. Where we do something and we expect something distinct, and we expect more. We expect more than what we, you know, that we put out. One of the more simple ways to understand that is, and when you have children, if you're a proper parent, you don't mind putting out. As a matter of fact, you look for ways you can put out to be able to facilitate the child. And you know, that's your joy. Knowing that you're working and you're trying to save this money to put away for the bonds, for the kids, for the school, for the university. You're trying to, you know, get this facility, that facility. So you enjoy the inconvenience of the off-schedule. I mean, it's like I'm just reflecting now on the body of the note saying, the suffering he experiences in the service of Krishna is his greatest joy. Bhaktivinoda said that everyone in the mat should be ready to spend, to shed 200 gallons of blood to uplift, I'm using my words on the last part, uplift every conditioned soul, every soul. So he was saying, Bhaktivinoda was saying, everybody should be ready to make all kinds of personal sacrifices in order to be able to help and to spread the mission of helping others and raising consciousness on the planet. And that they should do that willfully, more joyfully. You know, so this is making a call that, hey, this is what it means. Everybody should be ready to do this. And by getting notice and getting clear that. And he didn't say that the suffering is not a suffering, but the suffering that I experience on behalf of the Krishna service. He said, then that is my greatest joy. Meaning that if there's something I can do that's really a service, and even if it inconveniences me, or if it's an austerity, then that's the greatest, even a greater way I can show my love. In other words, to do something for someone you love because it's easy, another greatest way you know you really love. You know, the person's birthday comes, and you go down to the, you know, to the dollar store, and you buy them a little gift. You know, you say, well, I thought about you. And you have so much other means to buy something nicer or something that's more appropriate, you know, for your needs. But then you sacrifice, they know you sacrifice to be more aware of their needs, you're more attentive, and perhaps you restricted yourself for something you could have spent to there and you gave it to them. Then that's an even greater sign. And that's not expecting the same back. But you went the extra mile, you allowed yourself to undergo that austerity, and that was your greatest joy. So we're trying to understand that more. You know, because physical inconvenience is also now. When you have a little movement, it's like can be a problem. You know, you've all been sick with malaria sometimes, flu. Go to parts of the world if you're in. And when you like that, it's like it's hellish. And then some of you have chronic diseases. You know, people with chronic diseases. So you know that's intense. For someone to think, well, any suffering I undergo, we have a Krishna, my greatest joy. Like, wow, it's pretty far. I don't understand it. I'm just trying to meditate on it. Any other questions?
I was just reflecting on the composition in this letter and this question about being qualified to serve as a soul which is predominantly in the mood of neutrality. Mm-hmm. This is trying to reflect on Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami's writing in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where he defines this mood of neutrality as Aishwarya Pradhana Mantra Nahi Ganda. It has a great tinge of awe and reverence, and there isn't even a single tinge of any sort of mantra or affection for the Lord. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he came, he said, Chari Bhava Bhakti Dhiya Nachamu Havale, I'll give this four rasas and make the whole world dance in ecstasy. And following the footsteps of the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was like, no, how do we really reflect the word of neutrality?
It's like, you know, if you say your ras or say your mukti, it's a bona fide phase of liberation. But for the Vaishnava, we say kevayam narakate, that the hellish, the idea that to only have the aroma, to only smell the cologne, the perfume of your beloved, and not to be able to have the personal association, you know, with your beloved. Although it's a real experience, but for one who's had the experience of being with the beloved, then to smell the aroma just drives you crazy. You know, it's like you're satisfied. You know, so it's just like that. It's like, oh, I don't want that. You know? So you walk in the house and you smell the cologne of your beloved. You know, he was just recently there, and somebody said, don't be disturbed. You know, don't you smell the aroma? He was here. No, I want him. You know, let me call his cell phone. Tell him to come back. You see a flower that your beloved had in her hair, or a headpiece, and you see it on the table there, and you think, she was here. She used a comb. She used to use a comb of hair. Yeah, but you want her. So if someone says, oh, don't be disturbed. You can keep the comb. Can be with you. You don't have to feed it. You don't have to flatter it. You just have to go. It's part of her. Yeah. Now, on a higher level, we know that what's called Padilla, that's something that's used, worn, accepted by a pure person. It does have unusual potency. But still, this vipalamba or seva, or associating with separation, is powerful, but one wants symbol, one wants union. One wants connection. Because connection is possible, it makes the vipalamba, very powerful. It's only vipalamba. If you're only away from your beloved, only away, then it's a sadness, frustration. But if you're away from time to time, knowing that you're going to come together again after a while, then that awareness actually intensifies anticipation and reflections of the past, reflecting on what it's going to be like when we together again. For example, the Acharya says, like dipping a red cloth in red ink becomes redder. So the separation intensifies the love. And that's it. Any last questions? Other questions?
Actually, I was just, as you talked about the Paramatma aspect, I just said, I think, Prabhupada only, that the person who is meditating on the Paramatma aspect, he can reach the passive state, as you said. That was my first question. The second question is, how do we understand the mood of Vaishnavas, like Vasudev Datta, who is ready to go to hellish planets, even for the sake of others, and also Ramanathacharya, and also like Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in this song that I am ready to be born as a worm in a devotee's family. I don't wish to go. So how do we understand that level of devotion?
We can't fully.
Yeah.
How can we understand someone like Vasudev Datta, who says, let everybody go back and let me go to hell? Let me take care.
they are stagnations, they're blocks, they're sins, and let them be free. How we understand from my Manujacharya, he's told that if you share this mantra, it'll have consequence. Or the gopis who were told that Krishna needs the dust of your feet, foot dust. But knowing the consequences of also, who would normally be considered an offense. We can reflect on it, we can try to understand the spirit of it. But it's not something that one can easily understand. But just to appreciate the small kind of analogies of a parent sacrificing for the child, or sometimes a lover being ready to give his life up or give her life up, you know, for the other person. We can get some glimpse of that nature. But it also shows a high level of transcendence. The one is just not oblivious, but just not concerned about their own welfare. See, even Bhagavatam said, even their Vedic kings, they were trained in the caring process. And Bhagavatam says that they were trained how to treat others' needs above their own. So a real spiritual kshatriya or ruler was trained how to think of the project, the needs of the citizens and living beings in one's kingdom. More than only. And then Bhishma says in Manusmita Design, how the ruler, the king, should know their constituents as well as a mother knows her children. And should take care of their needs, you know, for the same way. It's what we have in present day leadership and rulership. They're totally different. They have so much more of how to use others to get things, make things happen. And how to focus on one's own personal needs. And that's why anybody who knows explains it and heard him to tell me how offenseless chanting brings on compassion. So when we are really going deeper and deeper into the science of devotion, then compassion is one of the things that must grow. Even to the point that one is ready to make that kind of sacrifice on behalf of others. And if compassion, that bija is not growing, you know, then it's more interest, you know, in mukti or bhukti. The sayuni of the experiencing liberation on the very basic level. The one is more concerned with trying to escape from material variegatedness and material complexities. So, anyone else?
In the end, you mentioned about putting in more efforts and expecting mercy of Krishna. So actually, I was also reading your book, your commentary on Madhurya Kadambini, and you emphasized that point also. But it's difficult for me to understand how can I put in complete efforts and still expect mercy, like, and still depend on Krishna for his mercy. Because normally when I put in efforts, I normally feel I'll be the cause of whatever I get. So how do I go beyond that consciousness?
Well, you do it every day in your job. You make effort, but you're still dependent on mercy. In other words, you can have, you know, a good performance, but if your supervisor doesn't like you or doesn't respond according to your quality of service, you're in trouble. And you expect that the person is going to be fair, and you wish there would be even more fair, that they see that you're trying and you work hard, and they do something to encourage you. So, you know, we kind of do that. In our day-to-day experiences in different ways in school. I mean, in school you work hard and you pass, you study, but still you're at the mercy of the professor, the teacher. You can have a professor who just doesn't like the way that you write or like your kind of idea, doesn't like the theme of your dissertation. And even though you put so much energy into it, for them it's just not a part of their value system. It's not a part of how they, you know, perceive in the world. They're, you know, harsh with you. So you would expect that they appreciate what you're doing. Even though they may not agree, they would give mercy of the fact that you've done, you know, what was necessary. You know, I kind of had that experience at Princeton. I was even a little wild then. So I did my dissertation on Western psychology and Eastern philosophy. And all my dissertations I think in those days were like 75 pages or 50 pages. So I did about 250 or 220 pages or something. So I mean, I worked really hard. And because it's unusual, as much as I did experiment in hypnosis and you know, in regression, so that was unusual. And I was talking about yoga, so I had, my advisors were divided between the religion department, the psychology department, and also, I think, the philosophy department. So when it came down for my dissertation, for me to defend it, everybody was disturbed. Psychology professor was disturbed because he was new to Princeton. And Princeton at the time was very behavioristic oriented, and to have somebody to do something like I did. And so he was afraid he was going to lose his job. Somehow he didn't monitor me about the, you know, the experiment. He was just new, you know, just new to the campus. And then the Eastern religions professor, he was kind of intrigued, you know, he was talking about, you know, yoga and these kind of things, philosophy guy. Figured everybody has their right to have whatever philosophy they want, so to speak. But the thing was that the psychology professor wanted to fail me. Because he kind of felt, if he failed me, then even though they were going to get on him that I did this experiment, that they would at least see that he didn't support it. Even though they're still going to get on him, that how did you let him do this? I mean, what I did was a little dangerous because I was hypnotizing people without having full understanding of some of the effects of it. And I wasn't a trained psychiatrist or a trained hypnotherapist. So, in you know, some cases it was dangerous, you know. And, you know, maybe he might get sued to school. But it was all done through the normal, you know, scientific method. So they couldn't reject it that it was improper scholarship. It was dangerous, and you know, more dangerous than the stuff, not even dangerous stuff they do at NIH sometimes, in the clinical trials, and you know, it's not that. They may save your life, they may kill you, they may give you complications, but they have certain scientific ways of how to do it. So, I'm bringing that up only to bring the point that there was a case where, you know, I was looking for mercy at some point because I was thinking, well, you know, it really all my fault. You know, you could have checked on me a little closer and changed the nature of it, but you know, I think Krishna didn't let him because I learned from that. It was my last kind of kick to go right into a total spiritual lifestyle because I became convinced about reincarnation from the experience. But then, you know, his idea was I should have been merciful to him. That, you know, he worked so hard to get to Princeton and now he's going to get thrown out of the apartment, you know. And then Krishna arranged it that mercy came for both of us. When I came to give the oral to defend it, the religious studies, the head of the religious studies department, wanted me to explain something about the nature of the jiva. And before I could even start, then the philosophy professor and him, philosophy professor started sharing something. And then the two of them start arguing. And then I just smiled internally. I didn't want to show my face. But then later when I answered, I said, so, if the two of you, very astute scholars, who've been reading books before I was even born, probably, on some of these topics, and you haven't come to a conclusion about this, and why do you feel that my sharing is something that has to be so categorical based on what you think when you don't share the same ideas yourself? And then the psychology professor got off the hook. And they gave me a grace, they passed me to get me out of it. My whole life is a life of extremes. Marla was saying the other day that, you know, he's a very practical doctor, you know, allopathic doctor. So when I told him the day after the festival that I started getting these huge knots in the lymph area, the muscles got hard. And then the other day when we saw cancer in
the bone. And he said he didn't think of it as fast himself, you know. Okay. Somehow, I always have this extreme nature that whatever I do is so extreme. So, maybe on a jet path for some unusual closeness to death, a remission, or a jet path to transcendence. So, we have to see. But we're bringing everything to a closure as necessary by Kripanatha's mercy. Like we're going to have this book that we're reading from now, die. Before dying, really, in a couple of weeks. And this would be the fastest one he ever got out. No. I mean, he did a miracle a couple of weeks ago and got Sri Upanishad in the second edition of Spiritual Warrior 2. We have Spiritual Warrior 6. And we have two other books, Sipa Principles of Bhaktisiddhanta in the folk community. And we have a book on Aparad. Small book, which I don't even know about yet. It's small. So, we're trying to see how we get most of the knowledge possible before we decide to become a stone in the dust. Any last questions? I mean, you can see that, the death is exciting. I mean, it's not to be fearful. It's like it's fearful when you get married. Fearful when you graduate. Huh? If you want to be eternal students. When they graduate, you got to get a job now. You know? It's fearful when you sell your house or you leave your apartment and you go to another place. You know, I mean, transition is challenging. And somebody who says it's not, you know, you wonder if they're being real. That, just think about it, some of you sold a house. When you leave that house, it's like a death. There's grief. You know? You know, sometimes people, you know, even if everything is out, they just look in the window, they come back in the door, look around, and think about where everything used to be, and, you know, the void off a basis of the house, and then you go. You know, you get a new car, even though your old car is not so good anymore, you turn it in, you get a new one. So you turn in a new body, you turn in an old body, maybe get a new one. Some people still try to hold on to that old car. It's just breaking down and breaking down, and they just keep trying and trying. It's just by here and breaking down and breaking down. Just trying to keep it around a little while longer. Maybe we'll. Please. But nice that I've been able to personally to discuss the passages from the book also, that before dying.
Okay. I was wondering, since you're speaking, all religions have been in the past, religions all about death, and everyone kind of knows theoretically that you will be leaving, yet we know that many of your disciples, some are somewhat in denial, some just maybe afraid to talk about the fact that you will be leaving. Some emotionally really don't have an understanding how to deal with it. So many different things may be there with disciples and even friends, well-wishers. So I was wondering if there's something you can share with all of us and how best all of us can kind of face what's happening with you, given that there will still be emotional things going on.
Go to a funeral home, go to a cemetery, go to, you know, a hospital, critical ward, and just see what happens to the body. Realize that in most cases there was a healthy entity at some point, and then at some point, you know, one wasn't healthy, or the body changed. See, there's some people who will never really be ready to, you know, accept death. That's why sometimes some funerals they leave the casket closed, because some people, even though the person is gone now, and the corpse is in the body, they want to jump in there and pull that corpse out, you know. Or they want to jump in with it, you know. Some people, even to the last moments of separation, they're not ready to accept it. And it's hard. I mean, you went to a funeral, and you see, you know, when they put their casket in the ground, it's heavy because it's like, you know, now you've got to realize that body is gone, and you're not going to see it anymore. People scream and they faint, and sometimes they have heart attacks, and sometimes they're in depression for the rest of their lives. So the easy way to deal with this is to not let the person die, and to let them live on through oneself. So we let Prabhupada live on through representing him, live on to remember his teachings, let him live on to create a community that represents the ideas, you know, that he stood for. That's that saying right there by Kubera's head. Srila Prabhupada was talking about Gandhi, and he says the best way to glorify someone, you know, a memorial service, best way to glorify someone, not just to build monuments and horrific glorifications, but to create communities, environment, institutions to represent the ideas of the person and the person lives for. So those who have the greatest difficulty in my or somebody else's transition, they should work even harder to see that the Guru stays alive through them. Some nice examples. Like Kamalakrishna disciples, some of Govindamaya disciples, some of them have made such a mission. And they're getting their Guru's tapes available for other for the world. Or they have packets of books in such a nice way, and the material goes on. Or they have created something that allows them to be constantly serving the spiritual master in his absence. So some of those who are very close, they've done something like that. And that's allowed them to have the Guru to live on through them. So, first is to just realize, to accept the reality that death is there for everyone. And the second is to try to allow the Guru to live on through creating something that one can make as an offering, an ongoing offering. Because, you know, you realize now, the way things are going now, I mean, you know, one day you may come along, I'm gone. Or the way things are going now, or if it's in the bone here, what else is in the bone? And so, in weeks or months, you know, and we're going like that. And then according to the physicality as well as the spirituality, is that at what point do I get snatched out of the body? I mean, if I'm just praying that if my gradual deterioration is the best for service to all of you, then good. But if not, well, gets to the point that the pain is unbearable, then I can just be, you know, on painkillers, intoxicated with the painkillers all the time, you know, or, you know, to go. Most likely at that point, I just to go. Good. All right? So, don't think this happens to someone, it doesn't happen to everybody. You know, nobody who won't go to having to leave in some way. Even when the Lord comes in different incarnations, he also leaves. And this movie that they show, we've heard about the Passion of Jesus.
Passion of the Christ.
Of the Christ, yeah. Where you see here someone, here he left 33 years old. Not so, most of you are older than that. And it was over the top, but you look at the suffering that he went through on behalf of others, and you realize this is a calling that one must be able and willing to do if necessary. And then it's suffering, but it's a little different, you know. You're going through the inconvenience, you're going through the pain, but there's a difference. I'm trying to focus and understand that a little better as I'm experiencing it. I'm experiencing, you know, tremendous inconvenience, not being able to do things that I usually could do, or being confined for 7 months now, just doing treatment after treatment all day long. And then, you know, like last night, you know, I had to like bridge myself so I wouldn't move in the bed, and Drew had to pick me up out of the bed and put me up, you know, so many things. You know, it's inconvenience, you know. But then, it's there, but it's also a little different.
So, soon I have the book, Die Before Dying. Get a copy of it. And it'll be clear for you. You won't have the crying and all that stuff. You can read it too clearly. It's confound the child of divine grace. Eti Bhaktivedanta Swami. Tiruvati. Eti Vata Gopina Prada Sanyu. Tell her
to
Maharaj. So you guys go down and take some breakfast. Sounds. Are you people, this is your mother?
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much for coming. So happy to see you. My daughter has done so much using her skills editing. And she,